Early on in Kyle Chaker's new book, Filter World, How Algorithms Flattened Culture, he refers to someone surfing social media. And I read this sentence and I paused and I thought, shouldn't that really be surfing the web? But when you think about it, you probably haven't surfed the web for years. You really are surfing an algorithm. We know what effects the algorithm has on our politics, developing an echo chamber of our own beliefs. But what effect is it having on the way we interact with arts and culture and creativity specifically? Kyle Chaker, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Do you think the internet is boring these days? It's sort of lost its chaotic charm of the early noughties, you might argue.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think as you were saying, it's kind of been overtaken by social media, where once we went to websites and kind of went to different places on the internet, now we just tune into these feeds of Facebook or TikTok or Instagram.
And I think people really have an idea of what the algorithm does. I mean, you get this sort of semi-conspiracy story kind of conversations between people where you sort of mention one brand of dishwasher and then all of a sudden it's turning up in your feed. But in your own words, what is the algorithm? How did it come to its current form?
Yeah, we often talk about the algorithm as if it's this one nebulous entity, like a deity or something. But actually, we interact with all sorts of different algorithms on a daily basis. So right now, if you're looking at your Netflix homepage or looking at your Facebook feed or your TikTok For You feed, those are all feeds of recommended content that has been recommended for you by an algorithm. And to me, like in a literal sense, an algorithm is just an equation that sorts content for you. So it'll kind of look at everything on a platform, all the stories and posts online, and pre-select for you which ones that it judges might be relevant to you or interesting to you. So it kind of tries to guess what you want to see.
I was reading the work of a colleague of yours at The New Yorker, Jason Lanier, on how to mentally picture AI or the algorithm, because we don't as yet have an icon or an image, a shorthand way of explaining it like we do, say, for phones or computers. So it's hard for people to get a grasp of how it works. I wonder if there was an image in your mind of the way an algorithm affects their lives, one overarching image or icon, what do you think it would be?
It's a good question. And I actually have a very specific answer for this at this point. I think the algorithm is like a funnel. So if you picture a giant funnel or a series of funnels, it is meant to take in the vast amount of data and user activity and all the decisions that are made on a platform, and then mush all of that together and kind of slot you as a user down into the narrow end of the funnel, like sort you into the category that you fit into the best with as many other people as possible. So maybe it's not one huge funnel, but there's a lot of different funnels. Like Netflix will put you in the horror movie funnel, or Twitter or X will put you in the political outrage funnel. And so each of them kind of funnels you toward a specific thing.
I'm wondering if I'm conflating algorithms and artificial intelligence. How are they the same? How are they different?
Yeah, I think algorithms are actually a form of artificial intelligence that we have all been interacting with really often over the past decade, just from being on social media. And they are a form of artificial intelligence because they use the technique of machine learning to continuously adapt themselves. So an algorithmic feed doesn't just work one way for all different people. It kind of adapts itself to what works best for you and what you might be more interested in. And it also changes itself over time. So it adjusts based on user data and activity to maximize whatever variables it's meant to maximize, which is most often like engagement or just people clicking on things. But then I think now when we talk about artificial intelligence, we're often talking about generative AI, which is all of these new tools like ChatGPT or Midjourney, which kind of produce something from nothing, or you tell them what you want and then it generates that from nothing. So that's kind of a different step into the future, I think.
Coming back to the core proposition in your book about the real life flattening of culture, you use the example of a coffee shop as a way to understand how the real world effects of this flattening as dictated by the algorithm works. Tell me about the coffee shop.
This was a kind of generic archetype of coffee shop that I first started noticing maybe around 2015, 2016, just in my work as a freelance journalist and magazine writer. I would travel around a lot. And I would start to notice that any city I landed in would have this specific kind of coffee shop that's very recognizable. It has white subway tile on the wall. It has exposed beams in the ceiling. It has mid-century modern furniture, succulents and ceramic pots. It serves cappuccinos with latte art and avocado toast. Like, it was just a very particular combination of aesthetics and symbols that didn't belong to any specific place. Though it was maybe established in Australia, was one of its home bases. But you could find it wherever you went, whether you were in, you know, Beijing or LA or Berlin or Kyoto, kind of anywhere you went, you could find this coffee shop design. And what struck me about it was, it wasn't that some corporation had demanded that all of these cafes look the same. It was actually all of these independent coffee shop owners who had organically gravitated toward this specific aesthetic. And they felt local, they felt like authentic and interesting, but at the same time, they were totally generic in relation to each other. So I think this book was kind of the end of a 7 or 8 year process of trying to figure out why those were happening.
If you've just joined me on RN Drive, writer Kyle Chaker is here. We're talking about the way algorithms influence the way we consume and interact with culture. This is the central thesis of his new book, Filter World. During the pandemic, Kyle, you decided to go algorithm free. You broke free of the digital bonds. They are so ubiquitous for everyone now. So how were you able to escape? Was it a cabin in the woods, or how much of a shut-in did you become?
I should have just become a hermit. I think that might have been easier. But I decided to do it while I was still living in my home in Washington, D.C. and trying to go about my normal life. But I cut myself off from all of these algorithmic feeds that I had come to depend on. So that was Twitter at the time. It was Netflix. It was Spotify. It was Facebook, though I hadn't been on that for a long time. TikTok. And I just wanted to stop getting recommendations. I wanted to kind of choose for myself what I was consuming and have things filtered by another human rather than an automated machine. And I quit them cold turkey for about 3 months. And it was really good for me, I would say. Like, it reset my relationship with the internet and made me more aware of just how much the internet has been shaped around these algorithmic feeds.
What sort of resets did you have with your real life interpersonal relationships, I wonder?
Well, I was much less in tune with what was happening on the internet. So that was an interesting difference because, as you might expect, a lot of my friends are very online also. And so rather than gossiping about what was happening on Twitter, I would have no idea what was going on. And I also just received the news less quickly. So I think when the Queen of England died, my wife ended up telling me like 3 hours later, and I just had no idea because I hadn't refreshed a New York Times page or something. I just was not used to seeking out the news for myself. But I do think it also cleared up my mind a lot, and it gave me some more room to appreciate the music I was listening to or the art that I was looking at, or, you know, time to sit down and read a book that was just laying around that I'd meant to read years ago.
Well, it sounds like you automatically had a conversation with your partner, so that's a good way. It does remind me, there was an excellent article in the New York Times Magazine recently about the Criterion Collection, and this is a collection of very cinemaphile films. It's more or less a database. It was a DVD and Laserdisc service. It's now moved online. But essentially, there is no machine-oriented recommendation to the films that are in part of this collection. Right. It's all driven by people who are absolute specialists in their bizarre sub-niche of film, whether it be noir or French cinema or Kurosawa. And the kind of point, I think, of the article was talking about how we've lost the risk that you take when we were, certainly when I was in university, someone would say to you, I got this new band, you should get tickets. I promise you they're going to be great. And you took the risk because you trusted mm-hmm. the person. We're missing that now because Netflix is on a huge, huge dump of content, but the breadth of the content isn't as important as the connection the content can make. Does that make sense?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think this is totally right. And it's a big shift that's happened where we rely less on other people to tell us what to be interested in and more on just these automated recommendations that come to us really passively. So like that concert involved taking a risk. Seeing a weird art film at a movie theater is a total risk because you're kind of stuck in your seat for 2 hours of a movie that might not be totally to your liking. But there was something valuable to that too. I think in the book, I kind of describe this as a form of friction. Like technology is so often about frictionlessness and passivity and serving you everything as fast and as quickly and as at high a volume as possible. And instead, like going to the cinema or seeing that weird concert, those are slow forms of consumption. There's a lot of friction. You have to get over your fear of awkwardness or impatience and kind of just put yourself in the moment of that experience. And I think that's something we need to reclaim now. Like we've gotten so used to relying on algorithmic feeds and digital platforms that we need to get off them a bit and take more of those risks. And like take the risk of not liking something, basically, since what our feeds are meant to do are just serve us what we are most likely to like.
And, you know, just misses the passion of that friend who's like obsessive about, I don't know, Radiohead. And whereas if you look it up on Spotify, there's no passion, there's no human element in that recommendation. I know that artists are beginning to game the system and produce art or content that will go to the top of feeds. And I can't decide whether this is kind of amazing in the sense that it's creativity that suits a specific format or stays within a certain kind of guardrail to achieve a certain outcome, or that it's completely creative free in that it is just painting by numbers to get clicks. How do you think about this? Is it sad or scary or exciting and innovative?
It's such a dilemma. I think it can go both ways. Like I think there's a cynical way in which some people adjust to an algorithmic feed and deliver exactly what that feed requires. Like I think some music on TikTok really falls into that genre where because TikTok is all about these really short sounds that anyone can post, a producer or a musician will like pack a hook into the first 5 seconds of a song. And that I don't think that makes for good music necessarily. But then I do find it really interesting when some artists adapt to the formats that pop up on social media and kind of subvert them to their own ends. So I can think of some video artists who use the genre of ASMR videos or weird, you know, sensory stimulation videos and make strange art, you know, for themselves. So I think maybe it comes down to whether you are subverting the feed, using it for your own ends, or just using it to its own ends and kind of using it to get more listeners, to make more money, whatever.
Even the language around how we see and experience arts and culture on the internet is quite clinical. I mean, words like content would have been completely the realm of PR departments of big major corporations 5 years ago. And consuming, even the idea of consuming content, even the term curated, as you point out, is now used for social media feeds, not just art. It is almost as if we've been floating along in a kind of never-ending stream of content. Sometimes we get the sort of paralyzing effect of option anxiety. Tell me about option anxiety.
For sure. I mean, we have so much available to us now, and everything falls under this category of content. Like, no matter if it's a video or a song or an image or an article, like, it's all subsumed into this one idea of content. And I think, I mean, we turn to an algorithmic feed to tell us what to consume because otherwise we just wouldn't know. I mean, we're faced with so many options that we literally cannot process them all. And so
you could ask your wife.
If I was totally offline, she could be my filter. So that would be very romantic, maybe. But I do think, yeah, I mean, we need something to help us with this process. And it's either going to be a human being who we trust. I mean, possibly like a journalist or editor or a curator or an artist, or we assign ourselves over to the machine and kind of float along on that passive river of content and not worry too much about what we're consuming, which seems kind of sad and depressing to me.
Yeah, I think the fingerprints of a human editorial direction is so obvious and so much more valuable than anything an algorithm, even if it is based off the history of your previous choices, can deliver. Fascinating. Yes. To talk to you. My guest is Kyle Chaker. His new book is Filter World, The Flattening of Culture. And you can find more of his excellent writing at The New Yorker and The Guardian. Great to talk to you, Kyle.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
You've been listening to a podcast of The Drawing Room with me, Andy Park. For more great conversations, search for The Drawing Room on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.